This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The upcoming presidential election could prove to be one where every vote counts. So when candidates on both sides see potential voters who might be ambivalent, it concerns them. There's a great big block of young voters out there, and many of the potential voters in that block are new to politics. They are millennials, that 18 to 35-year-old group who now outstrip the baby boomers in terms of sheer numbers. These people could tilt this election in one direction or the other. So who are they? What do they think of politics, politicians, and these two particular candidates? Where do they stand on issues? Are they likely to vote? Later in the program, we'll hear from two young millennials about all of this, but we start with some expert analysis, because gosh knows, millennials are not experts on their own generation. Dr. Susan Roberts and Michael Bitzer are here. Dr. Roberts is an associate professor of political science at Davidson College, and Dr. Bitzer is provost and professor of political science at Catawba College, both frequent guests here. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Good to see you. And Dr. Roberts is fighting a cough and a cold, so thank you for getting out of your sick bed.
I will stay away from the mic.
Okay. And because numbers matter so much in this election, we've invited someone who knows a lot about the numbers involving millennials to be part of this discussion. That would be Alec Tyson, senior researcher at Pew Research Center, who joins us by phone from Washington. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
So how important, and I'm not sure which of you to ask this question, but how important is the millennial vote to the outcome of this election when you compare it to Gen X and baby boomers and the silent generation and whatever generations are out there that I haven't mentioned? How important are they?
Well, I think they're important because they're the largest group right now, and many people have said it's a watershed moment for this group of voters. I think it's also a test of where they're going to go after for the older millennials voting for President Obama. Can Hillary Clinton capture their imagination in terms of symbolism of being the first woman president? I think some of it is sheer numbers. And I may be, I don't mean to be cynical when I say this, I'm not sure that some of the voters, it's necessarily, are they going to deliver on the appeals that they're voting, the millennials are voting for? They just want turnout.
Yeah, I mean, here in North Carolina, if you look at the 6.7 million registered voters in the state, baby boomers are about a third. Millennials are now about 30%. And the projection is by November, by the time of the general election, those two groups will basically be equal in terms of voter registration percentages.
That's less than 6 weeks away.
Right, but we're still registering voters.
I see.
And the vast majority of folks registering in this state are of the millennial generation.
Alec, is it just sheer numbers, or is there something fundamentally different fundamentally different that these people are bringing to the political outlook and to the voting booth when they go there?
Well, I think you've hit on the key points here, that they now represent 31% of all eligible voters nationally. But the key question really is turnout. We know that historically younger voters vote at much lower rates than older voters. So although millennials represent as large a share as baby boomers in terms of eligible voters, it's a near certainty that more baby boomers will actually cast a ballot this election. Mm. So turnout is really the key issue for this young group of voters.
Now, there's a big spread between 18 and 35, and that's the generation that we're talking about. They're between 18 and 35. At least the eligible voting portion of them are between 18 and 35.
That's right.
And that's a big difference. I know I was a very different person at 18 than I was at 35. Mm-hmm. I was probably a better person at 18, quite honestly. But how will that manifest itself in this election? What can we tell by looking at older millennials about how they voted, what their points of view are, as opposed to younger millennials?
Well, Alec may know this more than I do, but I think some of it is you're developing a stake. By the time you're an older millennial, you have a job you may think you'll stay in, probably not likely, and you may have more of a stake in terms of a family.
But millennials change jobs every 15 minutes.
One hopes when you have a family, you're not changing jobs that frequently. But I think the older millennials may have, of course, they've been in other elections. They, again, jobs, family, other elections. And I think they're looking at candidates a little more seriously in terms of just, quote unquote, feeling the burn that was the appeal to younger voters, the younger millennials.
When the baby boom was young, I can tell you this, having been one at one time, although it's difficult now to remember that, we were very idealistic.
Sure.
How would you describe millennials?
I think millennials growing up in the kind of age that they have do seem that idealistic, but they are very different. They are more what I would describe social libertarians. I mean, if you ask them about gay marriage or if you ask them about other issues, social issues in particular, mm-hmm. they are very much, I don't care what others do, just leave me alone kind of thing. And I think the appeal certainly was by Barack Obama in 2008 to really energize this new cohort of voters coming in, really had a profound impact. And we know from political science research, if you identify early on in your socialization to politics, you will generally tend to hold that kind of party identification over time, even though you may grow more conservative.
It's hard to believe, but we actually did a program on millennials August of last year.
Yeah.
And you were on that panel, at which time, Michael, you said that this new generation is driving the rise of the nuns.
Yep.
N-O-N-E-S, in both party affiliation and religious identification. What does that mean for people running for office today, then?
Well, I think if you look at how they're registering to vote, the fastest growing group of voters in North Carolina are the unaffiliated voters. And millennials, almost 40% of them are registered unaffiliated. If you take baby boomers, only a quarter of baby boomers are registered unaffiliated. So they are driving a lot of this lack of attachment to things. But that doesn't necessarily mean, in my estimation, that they aren't partisan.
But
they just don't maybe like the labels.
Yeah. But when I was... Yeah. Well, go ahead, Alec.
Well, I would just jump in to add to that point. I think Professor Bitzer has it just right, is that while 41% of millennials nationally identify as independent, we know that most independents lean toward one of the two parties, and far more millennials lean toward the Democratic Party. And in some ways, Democratic leaners behave much like self-identifying Democrats. So I do think there's something there, as Professor Bitzer was describing, about identity or intensity of attachment. But when it comes to political behavior in an election like we have this year, the fact that millennials overwhelmingly lean Democratic or identify Democratic, 57% to 36% Republican, that will probably express itself in terms of their vote margin as it has in the past two presidential elections.
Susan.
Well, and there was a study not too long ago that curiously said around, I think, 60% did not identify with socialism or capitalism. And I guess the ism may be.
What's left?
Well, yeah, there's that.
And I think that we're right about the pure independents do not tend to get out and vote. And I think that we've seen different labels attached to some of these candidates.
Yeah.
And that is, what's really interesting is the female vote and Hillary Clinton and the way that was manifested itself in women that were what they call themselves, and I'm not making this up, babes for Bernie. And it was a little bit of a change in which women didn't say, and older women such as Gloria Steinem said, you know, you really, women have to vote for women. And I think that's another ism that's out there is feminism.
Yeah.
I'm going to go back to the nuns, the N-O-N-E-S, because you talked about their detachment from parties, but there's also a detachment of religious affiliation. And when I was a kid, there were two things you didn't talk about in polite conversation, politics and religion. And there was certainly one thing that politicians did not talk about, and that was religion. And now, as recently as Monday night, I think it was Monday night, Tuesday night, that they had the vice presidential debate.
Right.
The last segment of the thing, both of them were talking about their religious faith and how deeply they felt it and how it guided their personal principles and sometimes their political principles. If you're a nun, N-O-N-E, does that resonate with you at all, or does that strike you as just being slightly icky?
That would probably be a good question for the two millennials coming in later in the show.
All right.
But I would say you know, it's interesting. I think some of the research, and Alec can talk to this, done by Pew Research is showing that social evangelicals are certainly different among millennials than they are any other generation. And some of the numbers that I've seen, and Alec, please correct me if I'm wrong, social evangelical millennials are more accepting of things like gay marriage.
What is social evangelical millennial?
Absolutely. If you look at millennials here, I think there's a few points, and you guys have raised them, is that First of all, 35% of all millennials are religiously unaffiliated, or this religiously none that you've been discussing. And that's different than older generations. Just 8% of the oldest generation, the silent generation, are religiously unaffiliated. So it's absolutely true that millennials are less attached to religion. And when it comes to acceptance of issues like gay marriage, absolutely. 71% of millennials favor allowing gays and lesbians to marry legally. That's much higher than older generations. But I think when you raise the question of politicians and the line that they have to walk, this country remains a deeply religious country, and a majority of all voters say that it's very important to them for a president to hold strong religious beliefs. So in this respect, millennials are a bit different than the country as a whole, and of course, millennials are just one segment of the larger country. So when it comes to a vice presidential debate or a presidential debate, there are multiple constituencies that these candidates have to appeal to.
Well, and I think you also get to questions, and I think we may overestimate the number of millennials that are socially liberal. There are evangelical millennials, and sometimes they get put into the mix. I think also, as Michael pointed out, issues such as gay marriage, tolerance, access to abortion, these are the morality issues, the divisive social issues that sometimes fall under the umbrella of religion. And I think also you can look at numbers which are also declining in church attendance, and not necessarily just an affiliation with an organized religion.
Also in that program last year that we did on millennials, Alec, we had one of your colleagues, Scott Keeter, director of survey research at the time for Pew Research Center, and he pointed out that, according to Pew, millennials at the time were less interested in political news than older people. Has that changed?
No, that's absolutely right. And this is a function of age. It's true of millennials now as the youngest generation, but it was true of Xers when they were young and true of baby boomers when they were young, that young Americans, young adults, tend to be the least interested in political news. So they still lag older adults on many engagement measures, and it's connected to the fact that they're going to vote at lower levels likely than older generations. But what we do know is they are interested in this election. 74% say they've given it a lot of thought, and they think the outcome matters or the stakes are high. 70% say that it really matters who wins this election. And those two figures are about as high, if not a little higher, than they were in 2008 and 2012, elections where Barack Obama generated a lot of enthusiasm among young people. So both things are true. They're a bit less likely than older people to be engaged. But relatively speaking, they're about as engaged as they've been in the past two elections, which were high engagement elections for millennials.
Let's talk about that fascination with Barack Obama. Michelle Obama was in town this week to pull for Hillary Clinton and to shift the focus or to bring millennials into the fold because they were very supportive of her husband. They were very supportive in this election of Bernie Sanders and seem to be lukewarm toward Hillary Clinton. What does your research at Pew tell you about what these folks are feeling now in 45 seconds or less?
Well, that's a great point. I mean, there is a lack of enthusiasm for the current candidates. Just 25% say they're satisfied with their choice of candidates, the choice between either Trump or Clinton. They're a bit less likely than older partisans to say that either candidate understands their needs. And here's the key figures that I think really speaks to this question. Just 24% think Hillary Clinton would make a good or a great president. Far more say she'd be average or even poor or terrible. And the numbers are even a little worse for Trump. Just 19% think that he would be a good or a great president. So I think it's clear that they're not enthused about their choices this election. And if that has an impact on turnout or where how they ultimately vote, it may well.
Alec Tyson is a senior researcher at the Pew Research Center in Washington. Also with us, Dr. Susan Roberts and Dr. Michael Bitzer from Davidson and Catawba Colleges, respectively. We're going to take a break, come right back with more. We're going to inundate you with facts and figures about millennials in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the UNC Charlotte Department of Theater presenting The Aliens by playwright Annie Baker. Performance is October 14th through 16th and October 20th through 23rd. Details at arts.uncc.edu. And Seagrove Potter celebrating American Craft Week this Saturday from 10 a.m. till 5. Demos, hands-on activities, and almost 100 shops. Details at discoverseagrove.com. On the local news roundup, CMPD releases all all of the body and dash cam recordings in the Keith Scott shooting, what they tell us. First Lady Michelle Obama in town to stump for Hillary Clinton, what she said about Charlotte in her remarks. Governor McCrory acknowledges a need to repair relations between our city and the legislature. And the ACC announces new game locations after pulling out of North Carolina. Those stories and more on the News Roundup when Charlotte Talks tomorrow at 9, right here on WFAE.
On the next Diane Rehm show, Syrian government forces are on the verge of retaking the battleground city of Aleppo with air and ground support from Russia, Putin's strategy in Syria, and debate over U.S. moral and military responsibility.
Join the Diane Rehm show following Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking today about a significant and relatively new influence in politics because they're just coming into their own as a generation of voters, millennials, the 18 to 35-year-old voters, which are about to eclipse the boomers in sheer numbers. Dr. Susan Roberts from Davidson, Dr. Michael Bitzer from Catawba and College, and Alec Tyson, senior researcher for the Pew Research Center, with us in our studio. And in a moment or two, in about 20 minutes actually, we'll be talking to some actual real live thinking sentient millennials. we have recruited from the ranks of Catawba and Davidson Colleges. There has been a gender gap among voters in this election, with more women favoring Hillary Clinton and more men favoring Donald Trump. Is the same true of millennials?
Well, I think millennials are trying to look at – the women are looking at Hillary Clinton to see if they can pass – if she can pass this new wave of feminism. And I think for the male voters – there is this new constituency, the male, white, college-educated voter, and that would apply to the older millennials. That's, I think, something that's a little trickier.
Yeah, that's going to be an interesting facet, I think, this year, is college-educated versus everybody else. Mm-hmm. And I think that
because
divide—
Because they tend to go vote Democratic?
Well, no. If you break it down by race, mm-hmm. white college-educated voters tend to be more Republican, particularly
really?
Here in the South.
Okay.
But— this year, I think with Donald Trump's candidacy, that's going to be a potential fault line that we've seen. We talk
that
about
is.
The gender gap. We've talked about the God gap between, you know, differences between church attendance and those folks who don't attend churches. Maybe Alec has some information on millennials in terms of college education. But I think that's going to be a real fault line in this year's election.
And we had never talked about in terms of a white male college-educated voter in a very distinct term that had been, you know, male, female, white, black, and it had not been a category, and it's a very real category.
And I think just to insert female college graduates
female.
Who are white, that's going to be an
interesting number. Why was it not a category in previous years, and why is it now?
Well, I think it has been a category, but we haven't sliced and diced it so much.
Sure.
And we also have a candidate, I think, on the Republican side who has appeal to non-college educated graduates, particularly here in North Carolina. In the primary, it was very striking. A county's level of bachelor degree holders corresponded negatively to how Donald Trump did in the presidential primary. Mm. So Mecklenburg, with a high level of bachelor degree holders, had a lower level of support.
Let's go through some numbers here. I know numbers are hard on the radio, so we'll try to do this quickly and painlessly as possible. The Pew Research study that was released in August about voter preferences indicated that Libertarian candidate Gary Johnson's supporters are younger on average than those backing either Trump or Clinton. 32% were younger than 30. Pew reports 32% of 18 to 29-year-olds and 39% of 30 to 49-year-old voters support Gary Johnson, with significantly smaller support for Clinton and Trump among that younger group, and with 34% of the older group supporting Clinton, 24% supporting Trump. Have I lost you?
You're still with us.
I mean, you're getting close.
So, let me just jump in there. I'll try to stay light on the numbers, but that was a profile. The profile part is true, that Gary Johnson's supporters are younger than Clinton and Trump supporters.
Okay.
In terms of all millennials, it's not true that more millennials support Gary Johnson. Clinton has a significant lead over Trump. Polls show her around 40%, Trump around 30%. But Gary Johnson drawing around 20% of all millennial voters is a really important or significant factor.
Is that about Gary Johnson? Is it about libertarianism? Is it about not wanting to be a traditionalist? Or is it about the two candidates running for the Republican and Democratic
parties?
I
think it's about the two candidates.
I think it is, too. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's quite right that they're not satisfied with the two candidates. But I think it also has something to do with Gary Johnson. And maybe it's just what the other candidates aren't offering that Gary Johnson may, is that there's always enthusiasm to be part of political change, or as Bernie Sanders said in the primaries, political revolution, or as Obama said in 08 or 12, change. And you don't really see that necessarily from Clinton, and Trump is an outsider to politics. Go ahead.
I'm just going to say, why not? Because when you're young, you're very idealistic. We've already talked about millennials sharing that with baby boomers. They're very idealistic in their youth. And that played a role in the election of Barack Obama as the first African-American president. Why isn't it playing a role in this election with somebody who will be the first female president? Why not?
Well, I think that Hillary Clinton, by all accounts, should be capturing the imagination. We don't have candidates that, quote-unquote, capture our imagination any longer, and she's just not been able to do that with a female vote, which I think is very frustrating for her. In terms of general millennials and wanting to make something happen, they're more concerned, I think, which is a little bit surprising. First issue they can care about is the economy. Second issue is college affordability and student debt, which I don't think Gary Johnson can address at all. And that was the Bernie Sanders cornerstone. And now you're seeing it as you have the last with Clinton.
So we talked about how the millennials may eclipse in sheer numbers the baby boomers. But you have to add to the baby boomers, Gen X folks and the silent generation, et cetera. Are they substantial? When you add those groups together, where will the Gen X is kind of in the middle. You're kind of the filling in the Oreo cookie here.
Yeah.
So yeah, me too. Right.
Which
sure.
side will they gravitate toward? Will you gravitate toward identifying with the people that the Gen X people are identifying with, or the other way around?
I would describe Gen X, and I'm one of them, so I would describe them as kind of a bridge, particularly if you look at some basic demographics and party registration. They are very nicely in the middle between millennials and Gen Xers. So I think that this small cohort that's about 27% in North Carolina, Gen Xers, they are kind of the bridge between the two. I don't know if Alec has any information on Gen Xers, but
yeah. Well, I would say just right. Your picture of North Carolina is similarly nationally, that Gen X makes up about a quarter of all eligible voters. Certainly a quarter is a large figure, but it's somewhat smaller than baby boomers and millennials. And in terms of their party identification, also just right. They're not as democratic as millennials, but they're a bit more democratic than baby boomers, the two generations that they're between.
Hmm. Not all eligible voters vote. How likely are millennials who are eligible to vote to do so?
Well, maybe our analysis of current population survey found that 46% of millennials said that they voted in 2012. That's lower than the national average. And if you compare it to baby boomers, 69% of baby boomers said in the survey that they had voted in 2012. So there's a big gap here, and no more or only about half of eligible millennials could you expect to actually vote in this election.
But it will take, because of their sheer numbers, it takes a smaller percentage of millennials to vote to have as much impact as a larger percentage of some of the other groups who might go to the polls. That gives them a particular amount of political power. Do you think that they're aware of that power?
Well, I'm not sure that they are, and I want to just jump in and say, the younger voter has traditionally been the lowest cohort in terms of voting, and it's only somewhat recently that we've given them a name. We were, at some point, the younger voter, and we still turned out in lower numbers as younger voters. And I think Gen X being a bridge, but you look at this time, whether or not you can translate activity or protest such as Occupy Wall Street into a vote is yet to be seen.
Hmm. You say, Susan, that studies have shown that millennials differ in what they consider the norms of citizenship. Talk about that.
Well, I think one book that I have used in a class before makes a clear distinction between duty-based citizenship and engaged citizenship. people that are older are more likely to be, and you may have younger voters that do this, but more likely to be, identify themselves as patriotic. They may follow the normal ways that we measure participation in terms of voting, going to meetings. They're more likely to be organ donors, give charitable contributions. And I think for the younger voters, the millennials, they're more likely to say their participation is engagement in the community, volunteerism, thinking about, and, you know, this sounds terrible, but protests are back in. There was a period of time when people didn't feel the protest, the physical protest, was important. I think you see that as well as what I'd say and call hashtag activism for the millennials.
Well, if I understand what you've said correctly, you say that boomers are more duty, they have this more, this idea of being duty-bound to pay taxes, to vote, to participate in jury duty, military service, and that, as you just said, millennials see things likely more as service engagement, doing things in society to make a difference. Is voting not part of that?
Well, it's not as important as some of the other things, and it may be a function
of
being—
Are they mistaken in that thought?
Well, I think if you look at the political system, they're really interested in immediacy. What can I do now? What is palpable? And if they look at the dysfunctional government that we see, what difference does their vote make? The policy process is complicated. The policy process is slow.
But we've talked about this. Mm-hmm. The reason we have a dysfunctional government is because we voted them in to do precisely what they're doing. Yeah. We're to blame, not them.
Right.
So if they want to change that, you have to vote, right?
You have to be part of the process. Yeah.
Let me tell you what some people have been saying as we've been talking. Adam on Twitter, who must be a millennial, says many issues, because of what he says, many issues are important to me, such as LGBT rights and racial equality, but climate is the most important. We will be voting for Clinton and other Democrats because they are the only ones who take the science seriously. Is that something that could be spread out among many millennials, or is he an outlier?
Well, even if you don't dig very deep into the policy of each candidate, I think that's what Clinton has said, that Donald Trump does not understand climate change. And I think he says that himself. He's made denials. And I think science is important.
Alec?
Well, I think two points he made resonate with our data, that millennials are far more likely than older generations to say that global warming is happening, and not only is it happening, but it's human-caused. And then the other point that he made, millennials are more likely to prioritize issues such as the treatment of racial and ethnic minorities and other minority groups. So those comments resonate with some of the data that we're finding about millennials this election.
Peggy emails, my two millennial Bernie bro sons and nuns, like their parents, are very keen on Deborah Ross. Lots of their friends are as well. That takes it down to the state level.
Right.
Pew reports also that immigration is adding more numbers to this group of potential millennial voters. Should that be a warning to Donald Trump?
I think it should be a warning to the Republican Party.
Yeah.
Looking beyond this election, I think that there are some real concerns for the Republican Party when it comes to millennial voters. And part of that is the identification with the party and how do you look at it. You know, 4 years ago, the Republicans wrote an autopsy of the 2012 election and said, we need to diversify. We need to broaden our appeal. Well, in my estimation, they really haven't done that this year, and they could be continuing to dig a hole when it comes to millennial voters.
And even if they did decide to do that and believe that it should be done, something got away from them in this election.
Mm-hmm.
The electorate got away from them in this election. Their base got away from them.
Yep.
Is that something that can be fixed, or is the Republican Party broken in terms of interacting with its own base?
Well, there's almost a cottage industry of articles that say, where did the Republican Party go? How much damage is this done to the political parties? If we take the fact that younger millennials or millennials are less likely to be partisan, then they're less likely, if you have a candidate like Trump that is really eroding the Republican support for going to the polls, that's another whammy. That's making a decline in millennials that would vote Republican.
We've talked about this too, how the parties have flip-flopped over time in terms of their constituencies and what they profess to believe in. According to Pew, the parties are changing. The Democratic Party seems to be responding more quickly to changes in the population. They're becoming less white, less religious, better educated at a faster rate than the rest of the country as a whole, and are younger, because the Democratic Party is aging at a slower rate. What's happening on the Republican side, and what might that mean for this and future elections, particularly if millennials decide to vote in greater numbers, Alec?
Mm-hmm. Well, you have that just right. I mean, the country is changing. There are national changes that are expressing themselves within each party. The country is growing older as the large baby boom generation ages, and the Republican Party is aging faster than the Democratic Party. The country is also becoming better educated. More people are going to college, getting a college degree, and it's the Democratic Party that's gaining education more quickly. And, of course, the country is also becoming more diverse, and both parties are becoming more diverse. That's easy to lose sight of. It's just that the Republican Party is becoming more diverse at a much slower rate than the Democratic Party today.
And you also say that although the Democratic Party has had an advantage in terms of the numbers of voters who identify or lean toward them versus Republicans, the GOP has been able to make some headway by improving their standing among older voters. But is that a good long-term strategy?
Well, I'm not sure. So, go ahead, Alan.
Yeah, no, go ahead. I think your comments would be interesting here. Thank you.
Well, I think that, in terms of, you could look just to be cynical. I mean, they're aging out and won't be around in terms of voting in those numbers. But I think now you've got me off target here. But I think that if you look at if they're partisan voters, and they are, there are a lot of challenges for the Republicans in terms of whether for the Republican Party in the House, the Tea Party influence. You've got the Freedom Caucus, things that are continuing to fracture the Republican Party. I think that the older voters are continue to be, they regard themselves as more patriotic. They identify themselves as better kind of citizenship, and that is citizenship in terms of being a good citizen, and not immigration issues.
The economy and terrorism to the electorate at large seem to be at the top of the list of things on their minds on concern. Social issues like abortion and LGBT issues are significantly lower. Not so for millennials?
Well, for millennials, millennials have a lot in common with other generations, right? We're all experiencing in many ways the same thing. So the economy is the top issue. Foreign policy and terrorism are very high for millennials. It's just the case that some of these other issues, like treatment of racial and ethnic minorities, are also high for millennials. It's not that they have fundamentally different issues at the top. It's just that they have a handful of issues at the top that older voters don't.
And gun policy is among those issues that's very important, I'm told, to millennials. What does that mean, gun policy?
Probably Second Amendment rights.
Well, and more regulation from government. But I think it is one of those issues in terms of support by millennials. It's a little bit hard to unpack. And I hate to talk about millennials just like I don't like to talk about women as being a monolith or African Americans or Hispanics.
Are there appeals that seem to resonate more with millennials than perhaps with other generations that candidates can put out there or parties can put out there?
Well, I think you've go ahead.
Very quickly.
Well, just one thing we know where we were a minute ago is they're the most diverse adult generation in the country. So questions about diversity or treatment of minorities may resonate more with them. And we also know that many millennials are in the process of pursuing education or are of a younger age who are concerned with things, as Sanders mentioned in the primary, about student debt or the quality of college education. So those are two issues that may appeal to them because of where they are in the life stage.
Alec, I have to let you go. We have to stop because we have to go to a break. Alec Tyson, senior researcher at Pew Research Center, thank you very much for your time. Dr. Michael Bitzer and Dr. Susan Roberts from Catawba and Davidson College, thank you as well. When we come back, millennials. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members at Heartwood Tree Service. Emerald Ash Borer is destroying ash trees in the Carolinas and is headed here. Ash tree owners can learn about EAB and prepare to protect and keep ash trees healthy. Tree guidance at heartwoodtree.com. And UNC's Nutrition Research Institute presenting a public lecture. Breast cancer. Could your diet be a factor? October 18th, 6 p.m. at Restaurant 46 in Kannapolis. Details at UNC.NRI.org. Syrian government forces are on the verge of retaking the battleground city of Aleppo with air and ground support from Russia. Putin's strategy in Syria and debates over U.S. moral and military responsibility, the topic of the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can. We're about to speak to some millennials. Charlotte Talks at WFAE.org, WFAE on Facebook, or Twitter at Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
This week on All Things Considered, a voluntary integration program that's been busing Black students from Boston to schools in the suburbs.
I don't limit myself is the best way I can put it. I'm okay with being the only Black or brown girl there. In most environments, I am.
A personal look at desegregation, plus fact-checking the presidential candidates on the campaign trail. Listen to All Things Considered every afternoon.
I'm Mark Rumsey. Join me for All Things Considered weekdays from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We've been talking about millennials and their possible impact on this election. Now let's talk to two of them. Gloria Inluidum and Blake Brewer both come in on the young side of this generation, which spans the 18 to 35 demographic. Gloria is a senior at Davidson College, a Clinton supporter, and one of Dr. Susan Roberts' students. Welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Blake is a senior at Catawba College, a Trump supporter, and one of Dr. Bitzer's students. Welcome to you as well.
I'm glad to be with you.
Now, you've both been listening to us talk about you guys and making of these pontifical remarks about you. What's your reaction? Did anything stick out to either of you as being wrong?
Well, one thing I would say is, the mention of millennials and sort of their religious affiliation. What I haven't seen is a drop in religious affiliation, but sort of a non-identifying with a specific affiliation. So the rise of the non-denominational. I think it's a myth to say that millennials don't care about religion. In fact, I would say they're more spiritual than ever before. And I think there's been some research to say that millennials are actually making their way back to the church in a way. So I found that really interesting in response to religious affiliation. So.
Okay.
Yeah, I might have to disagree with that point a little bit just because I don't really believe that millennials, or at least the millennials I've spoken to, really care about candidates' religious affiliation. So I identify as a Christian. However, it's not one of the top five things that I would use to describe myself.
Does it speak to you when you have candidates, such as the case on Tuesday night's vice presidential debate, that spend time talking about their faith? Does that speak to you? Does it tell you something? Does it inform you about them in some way that makes you like them or dislike them?
Well, I think faith is a good indicator of sort of how they approach leadership. And so,
how do you explain Donald Trump?
Well, I mean, see, that's really the anomaly this year. But, you know, there's a lot of other Republican candidates who do value faith and a lot of voters that value faith as well. And so, like I said, Donald Trump is definitely an anomaly in this election. I'll be supporting him. But, you know, that's something that is of concern to me. But, you know, when I look at Clinton, you know, and her sort of appeal, I'm not really as a voter that's someone of faith attracted to Clinton.
Why?
I mean, it just doesn't seem to be something that's necessarily important.
Why are you?
Or the Democratic platform doesn't seem to think that, you know, faith is. It seems like we have this religion gap in this country.
Okay, well, let me talk about why each of you are supporting the candidates that you both support. First of all, is this the first election that you've both voted in?
Yes.
This is
okay.
Very first.
And you are a Clinton supporter.
Yes.
Why?
Absolutely. I'm a Clinton supporter because I really do believe that she's the most prepared person for the job. I mean,
The candidates on the ballot today or ever.
I think I'm actually willing to argue and agree with President Obama and say that she is one of the most qualified candidates we've ever had.
Because?
I really agree with a lot of her different platforms. For example, I agree with how she wants to handle foreign issues, foreign policy issues, gun control, as well as just like her Supreme Court potential nominees. I agree with those. I think that's something that we really need to think about, and that's kind of put on the back burner as well.
And you're a Trump supporter. Now, I'm told that you were a Jeb Bush supporter first.
That's correct.
Then, when he dropped out, a Marco Rubio supporter, and then, when he dropped out, Donald Trump. There's a big difference between Jeb Bush and Donald Trump. So how comfortable are you with Mr. Trump?
Well, in some ways, I think there is a difference. But I'm comfortable with Mr. Trump because, you know, of what the party stands for. Lower taxes, emphasis on focusing on economic issues. And see, that's really what's driving me this election. I'm not really, you know, concerned about some of the other issues that have been really at the forefront. The economy is the number one issue for me in this election. And I see this election as a referendum on the Obama legacy and the –
And what is the Obama legacy?
Well, I mean, you know, you see the 2010 midterm elections where Republicans took the – the U.S. Congress, the House of Representatives, excuse me, and, you know, sort of this Republican majority since then in 2012, the Senate. But look in North Carolina. You know, for the first time in 140 years, Republicans took control of both state houses. In 2012, we elected a Republican governor with 55% of the vote. I mean,
we're doing very well, though.
Well, and then we have over 30 Republican governors, and 69 of 99 state legislative houses are controlled by Republicans. I think there is sort of this response to the Obama agenda. And I just saw something really interesting yesterday, I think in Politico. It was talking about the Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act and how it needs millennials to survive. And they were hoping millennial enrollment would be about 40%. Do you know what that number is?
Much less.
About 29 or 30%.
Yeah. And that's because young people are invincible and they don't know yet that they're going to get sick and die. They just don't know that yet. He's going to run for office. I can tell by the way.
Yeah, it seems so.
I'm not sure. You actually worked in the White House.
I did.
For a while as an intern, I believe, and you got a chance to meet the president, and I got a chance to ask the president one question, generous of them. And you asked him what he wanted his legacy to be in the African-American community. What was his response?
So President Obama was very gracious that I asked the question and that I saw him as someone who was obviously going to leave a legacy in the African-American community. He kind of responded with a funny joke saying that Michelle Obama is the bomb and that he knew that that's the legacy that the Obama administration was going to leave. But on a more serious note, he really did believe that race relations in the United States have gotten better. And even though we are seeing this rise with Black Lives Matter protests and like even what's happening in our own backyard right now in Charlotte. It's not racial tensions that are new. It is smartphones that are new. It's social media that's new. So we're just seeing it more.
Republicans have denied almost everything that the Obama administration says it has accomplished. And we can sit here and argue about this forever. But they've denied the decline in unemployment. They've denied the rise in the economy. They've denied almost everything, including that life is better for Black Americans in this country than it was 40 years ago, and including the fact that one person in the Republican Party said the other day that there was no racism until President Obama took office.
Yeah, that's just the most ridiculous thing that I've ever heard. I mean, I grew up in Raleigh, North Carolina, but my mom grew up in South Carolina, and her brother was the first person to integrate the school system. And like my mom and family have, you know, witnessed systemic racism our entire lives. But I mean, the fact that like I am able to attend Davidson College and feel safe and like it's not an issue is a humongous improvement.
What's at stake in this election in your minds as voters who identify with Hillary Clinton, Gloria, and with Donald Trump, Blake? What's at stake?
I think a lot is at stake at this election. When I think about Donald Trump waking up one day and Donald Trump being my president, I feel a little sick to my stomach, to be honest. I really believe that Hillary is going to do something to address climate change. She's going to do something to address women's rights, equal pay for equal work, human rights, gay rights. I really think that she is going to help with the federal deficit, immigration, huge issue. But also, I really wanted to point out the fact that like even though Donald Trump has this whole nationalistic argument, we need to protect our borders, we need to have this whole Muslim ban, I really think that at a time in which nationalism and populism are at a rise, millennials are kind of rejecting this notion because we're also witnessing the single biggest moral crisis of our generation being the Syrian refugee crisis and everything that's going on there.
Blake, what's at stake?
Well, I want to find a job in May, and so that's really the number one thing for me. And so it's you know, like I said, it's a referendum on the Obama legacy.
But unemployment is down. The economy has risen. Home prices are rising. Home sales are rising.
It's not to say that there hasn't been, you know, improvements, but to the extent of, you know, what influence the federal government has had in that. Like I said, the states are really a laboratory of democracy. And there's been – just look at North Carolina.
So what does your candidate bring to the table that helps you achieve what you see as the stakes in this election?
Well, I think that he brings the business experience. I think that he brings in a more pro-business platform with the Republican Party. You know, you had mentioned the national debt, and I think that's a huge issue. And when President Obama took office, it was $8 trillion, and now we're about $20 trillion, you know. And, you know, it's unpatriotic to, you know, let this debt bloom, but here we are. And so, you know, we talk about
I've had experts on here say that debt's not a bad thing if you use it right.
Well, at some point, America's got to pay its credit card bill.
And and how do you do that if you have a strong – because this is what he advocates. This is what Republicans advocate. How do you do that if you want a strong military, stronger than it is today because Donald Trump says it's in shambles, and you don't want to raise taxes?
Well, it's about
– How do you do that?
I think it's about smart growth with military, you know, making us more efficient, not necessarily bloating the size of our forces. But another thing that we absolutely have to talk about is, you know, we're talking about free health care and free education. And essentially, that just means more and more taxes, which stifles, you know, business growth and job growth in this country.
But what about the wealthiest 1% in America who are being given tax breaks? Like, do you think that that's fair?
Well, overwhelmingly, those at the top are paying more than, you know, more. They're carrying more of the tax burden. You know, I think it's near 50% of Americans don't pay taxes. And
Donald Trump apparently doesn't pay taxes.
Well, you know, like I said, his taxes are under audit, and so
don't give me that.
Yeah. Well,
you describe yourself, Gloria, as fiscally conservative and socially liberal.
Yeah.
And you say you don't want to pigeonhole yourself, Blake, but you say you're physically and socially conservative. Can the two of you get along?
You know, I don't know if the two of us should ever talk about politics together, but
I have great friends who are Democrats. Some of my best friends are Democrats. We just completely disagree on policy.
Really?
Yeah.
So in terms of being socially being fiscally conservative, you can agree on that.
Yeah.
So where would you save money? Would you raise – you want to raise taxes.
I would like to raise taxes.
Why?
Yeah. I just think that I mean, it may sound like a dumb argument, but like how much money do you really need? You know, if you're sitting at the top, like can you not
– Well, I would say as much as you make.
Yeah. Well –
That's how much I need.
But yeah, I would say that some Americans, it's just like it's an unnecessary amount of money. And I mean, I just think you have to find room in your heart to, you know, give to the people who don't have anything.
When you hear that, Blake, what goes through your mind?
I just think of, you know, it kills jobs that people need. I mean, I'll go back to North Carolina again.
How does it kill jobs?
Well, I mean, if you tax away business, then you can't bring jobs. I think North Carolina is a prime example of that. And, you know, since
– I don't understand.
Well, since Governor McCrory took office and you had the Republican legislature, North Carolina has created – 300,000 new jobs. Unemployment's went from 8.7 to 4.6%.
But what about the jobs we're losing and the money we're losing because of socially conservative policies
like
HB2?
Okay, well, let me dispel this myth. WRAL reported the other week, Laura Leslie wrote an article talking about the economic impact of House Bill 2, or as some of the opponents claim, Hate Bill 2. Yeah. And the economic impact is 0.1% of North Carolina's economy. And does that hurt? Absolutely. But
it particularly hurts people in service industries, like in Charlotte, where we've lost all $100 million, at least by some estimates. You're talking about waiters and waitresses and restaurants and hotel people that are going to be impacted by this.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, a couple weeks ago, that there were talk of repealing the Charlotte ordinance, and in turn, the legislature in Raleigh would repeal House Bill 2. And they actually had the 7 votes to repeal it, and that would override Mayor Roberts' veto. And a Democratic lawmaker got on the phone and called two Charlotte City Council members to change their votes. This isn't –
But that HB2 does not require Charlotte – to repeal that does not require Charlotte to repeal
But is it? It's in response to a law that overstepped its constitutional authority.
All right. So Let's talk about the gubernatorial race, mm-hmm. because that does affect everybody in North Carolina. Are you voting straight party ticket on this?
Yes, absolutely, straight party ticket on this one.
I voted for Pat McCrory, Danforth, and the rest of the Republican ticket.
You've already voted.
I've already voted by mail. Well,
because your absentee ballot, is
correct.
That why?
I won't be home on election day.
What was that experience like for you for your first election, the first time you got to vote?
Well, this is my first presidential election. I voted in the 2014 midterms, but it was, I mean, I was very happy to cast my vote. I'm very satisfied with the progress here in North Carolina. And that's not to say that there's not more progress that needs to be made, especially as it relates to education in the state, although we're making tremendous strides. But I was very happy to vote.
What about the progress socially? I just don't understand how I feel like North Carolina right now is just spewing hate. Like, and it's really hard to say, you know, to go an intern in D.C. and say I'm from North Carolina and everyone looks at you kind of funny like, oh, like I hear, you know, down there they check your birth certificate when you go to the bathroom. You know, like how can you justify that?
You know, we're going back to the Charlotte ordinance. It was a problem that didn't exist. I mean, there was no attempts by the Republican legislature in Raleigh to write bathroom policy before the Charlotte ordinance came around and, you know, the Charlotte City Council decided to pass this ordinance where anyone could walk into any bathroom. And, you know, that really opens it up. I mean,
right. But why did they need to hold a special session in the House of Representatives when they can't even hold a special session to raise teacher pay? But, you know, this bathroom deal is what
teacher pay in North Carolina has been raised about 13% since the governor took office.
So if the candidate of your choice does not win this election, will the republic fall?
No.
Yes.
Really?
I'm being dramatic, but I do think that it will be a dark day if we wake up and Donald Trump is president of the United States.
Why?
I just think that it is really, really horrible to have a president who spews hate, bigotry, who really doesn't have much of a plan at all, I would argue, for a lot of these huge
issues. As a member of the basket of deplorables, I think that the country will go on regardless of Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump's president. And, you know, I sure hope that that's Donald Trump. But, you know, I think democracy will survive. And if anything, this election is going to teach people that they need to get out and they need to vote.
Are most of your friends voting?
Yes.
They say they are, so let's hope they are.
What would you say to them to make them vote? Quickly.
Do not use your vote as a protest vote. Vote for Hillary Clinton, not for Gary Johnson.
It's an important election. Vote whoever he thinks.
Blake Brewer, from a Republican from Catawba College, Gloria, and Lewidim, a Democrat from Davidson College, both millennials. Thanks.